This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Adam McKay, wrote and directed the new movie Vice, which is nominated for 6 Golden Globes, more than any other film. The movie stars Christian Bale as Dick Cheney and covers Cheney's years from the time he flunked out of Yale to his 8 years as President George W. Bush's vice president, when Cheney used various means to turn himself into perhaps the most powerful vice president in American history. Vice draws on the work of investigative journalists and combines that with some speculation and comedy. In that respect, it's similar to McKay's previous film, The Big Short, about what led to the financial crisis of 2008. McKay has also made straight-up comedies like Anchorman and Talladega Nights. He's a former head writer of Saturday Night Live. He directed Will Ferrell's 2009 one-man Broadway show satirizing George W. Bush. McKay also co-founded Funny or Die and the improv group Upright Citizens Brigade. Getting back to those 6 Golden Globe nominations, they include Best Motion Picture Musical or Comedy Acting nominations for Christian Bale as Cheney, Amy Adams as Lynn Cheney, and Sam Rockwell as George W. Bush, and nominations for McKay for his writing and directing. Let's start with a scene from Vice, when George W. Bush asked Cheney, who at the time was CEO of Halliburton, to be his vice presidential running mate.
I want you to be my VP. You're the solution to my problem.
I'm CEO of a large company. I have been Secretary of Defense. I have been Chief of Staff. The vice presidency is mostly a symbolic job.
Right, right. I can see how that wouldn't be enticing to you.
However, the vice presidency is also defined by the president. And if we were to come to a different understanding.
Go on. I'm listening.
I sense that you're a kinetic leader. You make decisions based on instinct.
I am. People always said that.
Yeah. Very different. Very different from your father in that regard. Now, maybe I can handle some of the more mundane jobs, overseeing bureaucracy, managing military, energy, foreign policy.
That sounds good.
Adam McKay, welcome back to Fresh Air and congratulations on the film. Cheney has a legacy. He was one of the most powerful vice presidents in American history. How are his accomplishments still with us, for better or worse, depending on your political point of view?
I mean, there's no question Cheney is a brilliant bureaucrat, a brilliant operator. He has a patience and an intelligence in viewing Washington, D.C. and how the gears of power work. What Cheney conditioned us to get comfortable with was the idea of, you know, extraordinary rendition, extreme interrogation, these ideas that 20, 30 years ago would have been considered outlandish, suddenly were very comfortable to the American people. And then the biggest thing he did was by going to war, and then in the end, turned out the intelligence was bogus, which I think if you're right wing or left wing, I think you have to agree that was the case, and how America just moved on from that. And I think at that point, we started to get comfortable with the fact that our government wasn't entirely working for us and that there were agendas inside our government that didn't represent the will of the people. So I think in an abstract sense, he changed the way we view government. But then in a very tangible sense, I mean, let's face it, the Middle East became completely destabilized. You had the rise of ISIS. You know, they tripled the debt. And then, obviously, the world economy collapsed. And they were really the first administration to nakedly put lobbyists and corporate insiders in regulatory jobs.
So we're talking pretty seriously about former Vice President Dick Cheney's legacy. Your film is not only a kind of historical look back at Cheney, but it's an entertainment. I mean, it's funny, it's lively, And it's not a documentary, you know, and it's not a straight out drama by any means. So you had to find a tone, like you had to do with The Big Short. You had to find a tone to tell a complicated story that has had a profound effect on the world, and to do it in a way that's entertaining and that's, you know, fun to watch, and that's fast paced, yet you can absorb the information that you're getting. So what kinds of things did you have to think through before figuring out what is the tone? What is the structure? How do you pull this off?
A lot of it comes from the fact that I do this research, and a lot of it looks very dry and seems not that interesting. And then I'll find things like that Dick Cheney had an office basically everywhere in Washington, D.C., and I'll go, holy moly, this is crazy. And I think a lot of the ways that people like Cheney have gained power is that they rely on us being bored. They rely on us looking at what they do and assuming that it's just bureaucracy and who cares. And when you really dig into it, it's very exciting stuff, and it's major stuff that changes the world. So as kind of a fan of movies, I really get a kick out of bringing that to life. So, boy, when you're talking about Dick Cheney, I mean, he really has no signature speech. There's no great Dick Cheney moment where he was in front of a pulpit delivering a great line. There's no moment of Dick Cheney sort of establishing himself as a figure in American history. He's always kind of just been in the background. And so I had to bring him to the foreground to show what he was able to do. And there's a lot of moves and a lot of stylistic leaps you can take in movies that you can't do with other mediums that worked really well with this guy.
There's a scene I want to play from fairly early in the film, and this is when Cheney is a young man. And he was, and I didn't know this about him, but apparently this is true because you say most of the stuff in the film is true. He was expelled from Yale.
Mm-hmm.
And
Yeah, his Lynn actually worked with a local businessman who was able to give out 2 scholarships to Yale every year. But back then, Yale did not accept women. And so Lynn was a straight-A student. You know, Dick Cheney was more of a B student, and she talked her boss into giving Dick a scholarship.
Huh. So did he flunk out?
There's one story he tells, and he doesn't tell a lot of stories, but there's one story he tells about being drunk at a party and riding a tricycle down a staircase, very, very drunk. And I think he partied a lot. He lost his scholarship initially. His family tried to scrape together money to keep him there, and then eventually he flunked out.
It's so hard for me to imagine Dick Cheney riding on a tricycle, drunk down a staircase. But you also, in the screenplay, have how he was arrested for driving under the influence. And Lynn Cheney reprimands him and basically gives him an ultimatum. What background did you use for that scene?
That is a story that Dick Cheney talks about a lot, and Lynn's referred to a lot. And you know, that was a moment where Dick Cheney had flunked out of Yale. He was working as a lineman in Wyoming. We're talking the early 60s. That's a tough state to work in. And what would happen is they would work on the lines all day. They would, you know, climb up and put up the power lines. I think he was an apprentice lineman, actually, so maybe he wasn't fully climbing to the top of the pole. But and then at night they would go out and they would drink, like old-fashioned 19th century drinking, and he got a couple DUIs, and I think it was even a little bit more than that too. There, you know, to get a DUI in the early 60s in Wyoming, you're really doing some shenanigans with your driving. So we know there was some extreme stuff going on, but he loved her. He loved Lynn Vincent from the second he saw her when he moved from Nebraska to Wyoming when he was, I think, 11 years old. He was crazy about her. And, you know, there are a lot of cases where your girlfriend would say that speech to you and you would go, well, too bad, I'm doing this. But not him. He white-knuckled it. And what he did, it's actually an amazing story. He stopped going into town at night, and he stayed in this little crappy trailer with an old World War I veteran. And they would sit there and they would eat like canned tuna fish. And Dick would ask him stories about World War I. And that's how he stopped getting into trouble. And then eventually got back into college, went to University of Wisconsin, started doing quite well, and got on track with Lynn. And then they got married. They were actually boyfriend and girlfriend in that scene, and then later got married.
So you kind of depict Lynn Cheney as the kind of motivating factor and the power, the ambition behind Dick Cheney's initial climb.
No question. We interviewed some people from Casper, Wyoming, to this day, and they still say no matter who she would have married, would have been president or vice president, that this young lady back in those days was so smart, so ambitious, so talented. But at that time, there weren't a lot of opportunities for women, so she needed a solid guy, and she picked Dick Cheney.
In the early part of the George W. Bush administration, when you were head writer on Saturday Night Live and Will Ferrell was in the cast, he often played George W. Bush, even during the campaign, and you were his writing partner on that. And then after Saturday Night Live, you and Will Ferrell did a one-man show, and so it was Will Ferrell as George W. Bush on stage. Do Cheney and Bush look really different to you now than they did then, with the amount of time that has elapsed since you work with Will Ferrell on George W. Bush material?
Yeah, in the middle of that show, I really started noticing what W. Bush's position was, that he was a name. He was not a serious guy. He was, you know, by a lot of accounts, a fairly okay guy. He was fun to hang out with. And it was really clear when we were doing that show, and I think everyone kind of knew the joke beforehand that Cheney was pulling strings, but really it was during that show that I just was startled by how many decisions were made by Cheney. I started hearing all these stories. You know, the second tax cut they did for the super rich, they were at the big, you know, the table, and Cheney said, we should do a second tax cut. And Bush is like, we just did one. And Cheney goes, yeah, but that's our base. And they did it. And they did the tax cut. And there's another story where finally, you know, W. Bush has gotten Rumsfeld out and he's meeting with the next Secretary of Defense. I think it was Gates. And in the middle of the meeting, he just leans forward and he goes, W. Bush leans forward to Gates and goes, what are you going to do about Cheney? And I thought, that is a wow. That is a very telling story. Like, you're the president. Why would you? So
wait, what do you think he meant by that?
I think he meant like he didn't know how to handle him. You know, we know that Bush's father, H.W. Bush, God rest his soul, said, I never would have recommended Cheney for my son if I had known he was going to run a shadow empire out of the White House. I mean, that's an actual quote from his father. So, but that Gates story really stuck with me. I remember hearing that and just thinking like, wow, that sounds like a guy who's, I don't quite want to say afraid of someone, but can't handle someone.
So making Vice was a very eventful period for you. You had a heart attack before the movie was finished. Thank goodness you survived and seem to be in good shape now. What point of the movie were you in when you realized you were having a heart attack?
We had just finished filming. I think we had wrapped for about a week. And it's that period where the editor is putting together the rough assembly of the movie. Hank Corwin was working on it. So you kind of have this little week and a half, 2 week break. And I just realized I was not in the best shape. I had put on weight during the movie. I was foolish enough to continue smoking. Not a ton, but I was, you know, about a half a pack a day, below half a pack a day. And it just, I didn't feel good. My doctor was warning me. And I was working out with my trainer, and in the middle of it, my hands started tingling, and my stomach felt queasy. Well, those aren't normally symptoms you think of with a heart attack. You usually think of pain in the chest and the arm. So I told my trainer, I go, I'm fine. I'm just tired. This is just weird. And he left, and as soon as he left, I remembered the heart attack scene we shot with Bale, when he was running for Congress in Wyoming in the late 70s. And Bail had asked me, he said, how do you want to do the heart attack? Do you want it to be a pain in the arm, the chest? He goes, I could also do the queasy stomach. That's really common. And I remember asking him, like, what do you mean? I've never heard that before, queasy stomach. And he goes, oh, yeah, it's very common. And so that moment just flashed back to me while I was sitting on the couch. And I went, holy Lord. And I ran upstairs and I just downed 4 baby aspirin and called 911. And God bless 911. Within 3 minutes, they were there. And they had me at the hospital another 3 minutes after that. And the doctor was like, why did you take those baby aspirin? Like, I think he knew. Usually the queasy stomach thing, people don't react to that one. And I said, oh, my lead actor in our movie told me that's how a heart attack works. And the doctor said, because you acted so quickly, you have no damage to your heart. Your heart's as good as new. And then he said, not only that, you have an extra strong heart. So he said, the only dumb thing you're doing is smoking. So he said, if you stop smoking, there's no reason you shouldn't live to be 100 years old. So I have stopped smoking. That is the good news. And my heart is as good as new. But man, what a scary experience. So I called Christian Bale a week later and I said, either you or Dick Cheney just saved my life. And the craziest thing was they took me, they call it a cath lab, which I had never heard of before, the catheter lab. And they take you in there and that's where your heart doctor comes in, your cardiologist. And this was a guy named Dr. Henry, who's one of the best in the world, thank God. And they get to work on you and they're, you know, they're going to clear out that blockage. And they did. And they were amazing. And then towards the end, I was on, you know, drugs, obviously. And for some reason, I thought it was very important that everyone at the table know that I'd just done a movie about Dick Cheney and how ironic this is that I'm on a table having a heart attack. And of course, no one cares. But I sort of mumbled it. I was like, you know, this is weird. I just did a movie about Dick Cheney. And everyone ignored me, as they should have, except one voice to my right, just after a beat, just said, Dick Cheney, great American. And I went,
that's not the point of your movie.
I went, you know, it's I, in my mind, I was like, I don't want to argue with this guy. I think these people just saved my life. So I just went, it's complicated.
And for anybody who doesn't know, Cheney had, I think, like 8 heart attacks and a heart transplant. So, you know, the whole heart connection is very, very relevant.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I mean, at one point he had it basically a little EKG or a little jump starter in his heart. So when he would have a heart attack, it would give his heart a kick to keep it alive. And it had like a little computer in it. And I guess a couple of years after he had it put in, they were worried that terrorists could crack the computer code on his heart computer that he had in there. So they actually took that out at one point. But yeah, he had 5 heart attacks. But if you count, well, no. If you count the transplant, if you count the device they put in, I mean, you might be right. It might be that high. It's kind of hard to calculate. But he during the 1970s, when he was working in the Ford administration, the youngest chief of staff in history, he was smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day and eating a dozen donuts every day. So. Clearly not treating his heart that well.
So your wife, Shira Piven, had a brush with mortality too. She was in a car accident. She broke her neck. And in imaging her injuries, the doctors found a spot on her lung that turned out to be malignant, and she had to have lung surgery. How is she now?
Thank you for asking. She is 100% great. Turned out that it was a very slow-moving cancer. But boy, talk about a miracle. She went through this horrible car wreck and they discovered this spot. And she's doing great. She's the opposite of me. She's so healthy and vibrant.
I think it's just so odd that you both went through these transformative experiences at a similar time. I don't know how far apart her accident and diagnosis was from your heart attack.
It was like a month and
a half.
Well,
like nothing.
Her accident was a month and a half before her car accident where she broke her neck. And then the diagnosis was about 3 months after the heart attack.
So you went through these life-changing experiences at basically the same time. Did it make it easier for you to talk about it with each other and to understand what it means to have, a life-changing diagnosis or, a profoundly transformative medical experience?
The big thing I think we both experienced when I came out of the heart attack was I just had the biggest, dumbest smile on my face for like a week, where I could not stop joking around. I was so happy to be alive. And what it does is it kind of, for me personally, just reaffirms what you care about. And, there's a lot of things I love in life, but one of the things I love in life is like laughing really hard. And I mean that even in the face of these tragic stories that we're talking about. I just think it's one of the great things we can do. It did make me miss the comedy. I got to be honest. It did make me feel that, like, maybe there's something to be said about if you can come up with a raucously funny movie, that there's just something about that that's undeniable. So I definitely started talking to Farrell about maybe we have to get back in the saddle again and do another big old comedy, because there's just no better way to spend your life than like laughing every single day. So that I would say that's a change that came out of it.
Well, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, too.
Adam McKay is nominated for Golden Globes for writing and for directing the new film Vice. Pink Floyd's legendary frontman Roger Waters has made a recording of Stravinsky's The Soldier's Tale with a new narration that he adapted. He also performs all the characters. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
Down a hot and dusty track comes a soldier with a pack. Ten days leave he has to spend. Will his journey never end?
Igor Stravinsky's L'Histoire du Soldat, The Soldier's Tale, was a small-scale stage work conceived between the time of the Russian Revolution and the end of World War I, when elaborate productions were unthinkable. Stravinsky and his collaborator, the Swiss writer Charles Ferdinand Ramuz, created an intimate entertainment based on a folk story about the fateful meeting of the devil with a tired soldier trying to get home from the war. The soldier gets talked into trading away his precious fiddle for a book with the devil's secret for making money. Stravinsky uses only 7 musicians in what was his first real attempt to incorporate jazz or ragtime. It's an irresistible piece, theatrically manageable and musically alive, full of marches, rags, a tango, and an off-kilter waltz. Stravinsky soon turned the piece into a suite of music without any story at all. The folk tale is so ripe with contemporary overtones, various writers have adapted the libretto. The first cast consisted of a narrator, 2 actors, and a dancer playing the princess the soldier marries. Jean Cocteau narrated a recording in which Peter Ustinov played the devil. Mime Marcel Marceau once appeared as the devil. The strangest version I know was one rewritten by the avant-garde New York author Kenward Elmsley. a new adaptation by Pink Floyd's Roger Waters, is hardly a radical revision, but with Waters himself narrating the story and reading all of the characters, it's totally seductive. He's an effortless narrator, delivering the proper British English of the storyteller with impeccably good diction, switching to a Cockney dialect for the soldier, a German accent for the devil, and a higher-pitched voice for the princess. And because he's a good musician, his timing in the places where the narrative is woven into the music is just about flawless. His English rendering, based on an earlier translation, is full of tricky rhythms and witty and mostly understated rhymes. Here's the first meeting of the devil and the soldier.
The devil stops to listen for a while. He is intrigued. He quietly approaches the soldier and touches his arm. The soldier, startled, springs back in alarm. "Bye! Oh, you gave me a fright. Apologies. Excuse me. Could you by any chance be persuaded to give me your fiddle?" "What? Don't be daft. Why would I? No way." "Ah, very well then, I'll buy it. What if I pay?" "Hey, I don't think so. No. What can I say? This fiddle of mine is just not for sale." The devil puts down his butterfly net and holds out a book. A book bound in red, somewhat tattered and torn, a book he's been carrying under his arm. "I'll give you this book for it." "No, I can't bloody read." "Makes no difference with this book. There's really no need. It's more than a book. It's wealth untold. You've only to open it, and lo and behold, banknotes, bearabonds, and gold." "Gold? Well, I suppose I could just have a look." "Certainly. Be my guest. Here, take the book."
When I first heard about this recording, I was suspicious that it was going to be just a gimmick to cash in on Waters' fame. But Waters is surrounded by the terrific musicians of the Bridgehampton Chamber Music Festival, including Colin Jacobson, one of the founding members of the popular string quartet Brooklyn Rider, playing the devilishly difficult solo violin part. This is a seriously enjoyable addition to the Stravinsky catalog.
Lord Schwartz teaches in the MFA Creative Writing Program at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. His most recent book of poems is called Little Kisses. He reviewed a new recording of Igor Stravinsky's The Soldier's Tale with narration adapted and performed by Roger Waters. Coming up, we'll talk about driverless cars with former New York City Traffic Commissioner Sam Schwartz, author of the new book No One at the Wheel. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The future of the driverless car is going to affect the future of how we travel and what we do in cars. But driverless cars are also likely to transform roads, cities, suburbs, jobs, the economy, and daily life. My guest Samuel Schwartz expects it to be a very disruptive technology. Schwartz is the author of the new book, No One at the Wheel, Driverless Cars and the Road of the Future, which he says is about the good, the bad, and the ugly of how driverless cars will change our world. He knows a lot about transportation systems. He served as the traffic commissioner of New York City and chief engineer of the city's Department of Transportation. He now has his own consulting firm and has worked with cities around the world on transportation-related issues. We're going to use the words driverless car interchangeably with the words autonomous vehicle, or AV. Sam Schwartz, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, I've always, until reading your book, I thought of AVs, autonomous vehicles, driverless cars, as looking a lot like my car, except that I wouldn't have to sit in the driver's seat, or if I was in the driver's seat, I wouldn't have to do anything. But as you point out in your book, once you have an autonomous vehicle, you get to rethink the whole design of the car and probably also what the car is made of. I mean, let's face it, our cars are designed for like the gas engine under the hood and the steering wheel and the brake pedal. So give us a sense of visually, like, of how a car might be designed differently.
A lot of people have the image that you have, Terry, and a lot of them, they kind of look, the Google car looks like a smaller car, like a smart car, and it's got some intelligence on top of it. But I liken this a bit to the cell phone. In 1982, I was traffic commissioner. I had one of the first cell phones that I could use during emergencies. And the cell phone came with a man carrying it on a 12-volt battery and this huge phone. And today, the cell phone of today doesn't look anything like the cell phone that I had in 1982. The same thing can happen with cars. It could, the autonomous vehicle of the future, most people think that by the second half of the century, at least, and maybe sooner, we'll have no steering wheel, we'll have no brake. It will be a room. It could be a room any size. It could be a conference room. It could be, you know, the width of a house. There's no reason to think it's going to look like a car other than that's what we're used to. So others are beginning to think of these vehicles as being something totally different, different uses. And I see that as a real potential, as a meeting place, a sleeping place, an eating place. Medical facilities will come to you. It'll look like a hospital room or a doctor's office, a place to be examined by a doctor remotely, in which a remote stethoscope listens to your heart and your blood pressure is taken, and all those types of things are possible. Some of this is good, but we should go forward with our eyes wide open.
What's your assessment so far of the safety of autonomous vehicles and what that would be like in the future? I mean, on the one hand, you don't have a driver's misjudgment or a driver falling asleep at the wheel, so that could eliminate certain crashes. On the other hand, technology is always subject to failure, and computers often mess up. And they, you know, everybody's been on the computer when it just kind of freezes and you can't work anymore. So imagine that happening to your car.
And it could happen, and of course hacking could happen. But many of the features that autonomous vehicles are operators are claiming are needed, you don't need in the autonomous mode. So there is automatic braking features. There are lane control features. There are blind spot monitoring. There's a whole host of things that are being offered today to people who could afford it. So the low-income people are not getting all these safety features that could cut down on crashes tremendously. And then you take the driver out of it. Yes, you can reduce crashes further because you don't have to worry about the judgment of a driver, but you may create other types of crashes. Right now, the industry isn't sharing anything. This is really an industry that has tons and tons of data, but they're not sharing it with the public. The only data that's accessible is the state of California, which is reporting anytime there is a crash when a vehicle is in autonomous mode. And so far, the results are not good. So far, we know of three deaths and not because of any reporting. That's the media reporting of three deaths in autonomous mode. For conventional cars, that would take 260 million miles before that would occur. And here we have three deaths, and AVs have driven maybe 10 or 15 million miles. In California, which requires the reporting of crashes, the cars in autonomous mode are crashing 9 or 10 times more often than the conventional cars. Will they solve a lot of that? Yes, they're going to. They could solve a lot of the safety problems in the next few years. Everybody could have automatic braking. Everybody could have lane control protections and could have blind spot monitoring and other safety features. But there is this meme that we have to wait until we have autonomous vehicles for safety, instead of the meme that maybe we could do a lot now.
So what kind of features are you talking about?
Right now, I have a car in 2017 Volvo that will stop on its own if I'm not paying attention and about to rear-end another car. There are features that will let me know if I am leaving the lane. The car itself will tug and tell me that I'm crossing a lane. And so if I'm drowsy, if I'm not paying attention, or if I had too much to drink, which I would never do, I would know that. I know that there's a warning if there's a car in my blind spot and I'm trying to change lanes. So there are lots of features that exist today that if the industry that is claiming safety, 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 and that's why we need AVs would really focus on safety, they'd say we could have by 2022, every single car sold in America could be the safest car possible, and we'll make it even safer eventually with autonomous vehicles. But so far, the track record is not very good with autonomous vehicles. They can't figure out what a pedestrian is or what a pedestrian is going to do. They can't separate a child from a dog. Sometimes a tree branch overhanging the road will be taken as something in the way. So, you know, we're far from perfecting.
How good are AVs at recognizing a human being?
They're in the high 90s, they will percent-wise, but there are times that they'll have a false reading, or they'll say, I think this is a person, and this is what happened with the Uber crash in Tempe, Arizona that killed a woman. The woman was walking with a bicycle. So you would think, A, it would recognize the woman, and two, it would also recognize a bicycle. But the system said, I'm not sure what this is. It doesn't look right to me. So I don't want to stop suddenly because that also contributes to crashes. I'm going to plow right ahead. And it plowed right ahead and killed her.
Oh, yeah, I think I didn't understand how that happened. So let's talk about how AVs could affect transportation in terms of like traffic. And, you know, driverless cars are great if they're not stuck in traffic. And they're going to affect the amount of traffic on the road. Then they'll also affect what the road looks like. You lay out a scenario. There's a family with a couple of kids, two parents. The AV takes one parent to work, drops them off at work, comes back home, picks up the kids, takes them to school, drops them off at school. The autonomous vehicle comes back home, picks up the second parent, takes them to work, and then the car does, I'm not sure where it stays in between all these trips. But you point out in between trips, you have an empty car. You have what you describe as like a zombie car. So what does that mean in terms of like the number of cars that's going to be on the road?
Well, one way to look at the future is the intent of many people in the AV industry is to replicate Uber, Lyft, Via, and other car services, but without a driver. So in lots of cases, it would be an app or whatever succeeds an app. You will call for a car. The difference between that and an Uber today is there will be no driver. So we've already been able to determine a lot of things about these new app-based services. The average app-based service, when it carries you 1 mile, it needs to travel 1.6 miles. So a 10-mile trip means that vehicle would have traveled 16 miles over the course of the day. And that's because it's empty during portions of the day. The car has to get into position to be near with his density of people. So we already know it increases vehicle miles traveled. We also know that there's a concentration, unless we're smart, there's a concentration of where the well-to-do are. It's a concentration in most cities like New York, like Philadelphia, like San Francisco and Chicago, that a lot of the well-to-do are now near or in city centers where we already have the best transportation and the best transit systems. So what we've been finding is the congregation of the Ubers and Lyfts, A, where we already have good transportation service, B, with where many of our wealthiest citizens live, and C, where we already had the worst traffic. So the future, unless we change that model, is quite bleak, because there'll be many, many more autonomous vehicles out there because it'll be so inexpensive to run them, especially if they run as a fleet. There'll be no downtime. The average car today is in 95% of the time sits idle. These cars will be moving around doing their job 80, 90% of the time. So far more vehicles will be on the road. The other thing is, there is this hype from the industry that autonomous vehicles are so efficient, they could follow each other so closely that we could replicate on a highway the capacity of a train. That's nonsense. A train or a bus in an exclusive lane could move 100 people in 60 feet, or certainly a subway car. Whereas an autonomous vehicle, unless we change our behavior, is going to have one person per car. Even if it has one person per car, it may have zero, less than that. We'll be moving at most two or three people in that same distance. So the math doesn't work.
So are you like making an argument here that in spite of AVs, we need good public transportation? Like trains that can move a lot of people at one time with high density within each car.
You know, autonomous vehicles are coming. There's no doubt about it. We should maintain good public transportation systems. We should maintain, and I use the adjective good because there are bad public transportation systems out there. 90% of the country has lousy public transportation. It's called a bus that comes around every half hour or hour. It largely serves poor people. When a system only serves poor people, it's a poor system. Often it's largely people of color. We have an opportunity to transform public transportation in those areas, not to offer a half hour service, but we can triple the service by using microtransit AV vehicles. Small buses that are smart buses that are on demand, that know where the people are, know where they want to get off. We already have that technology. We have a company here called VIA that is doing it in New York, Chicago, and a few others. We have Ford Chariot that's beginning to do it in San Francisco and a few other places. The technology is here. So AVs could be terrific for lower density public transportation, but we're going to still need in the big cities, or in places where we want to move lots of people, the Northeast Corridor, you're going to still need trains, you're still going to need subways, streetcars. We can't substitute cars for that kind of service.
So, you know, we're talking about cars changing, and we're talking about the road infrastructure. What kinds of new highways will driverless cars require? Like, how might highways change?
If we're really smart, we can have less infrastructure if autonomous vehicles really look something like cars. If they have a width of 6 feet as cars have today, if you have a three-lane highway, the average three-lane highway is 36 feet, you're probably going three 12-foot lanes. You're only going to need, say, 21 feet. So you can either add more lanes and add more capacities to highways, or do something else with all that land that will be unleashed and not have to maintain as much infrastructure.
Let me interrupt you for a second, because you were saying that we're going to be able to like eat and sleep and have romantic evenings in our car. So that requires room. But if you're making the car smaller because there isn't going to be a driver, then there isn't going to be a space to like live in your car the way you described it before.
Yeah. So I go through the good, the bad, the ugly.
Okay.
What I'm painting right now is the good.
Okay.
And the good is they look like cars. They don't look like conference rooms. They don't look like houses. They don't look like coffee shops. They look like cars. What a great opportunity if they stay in looking like cars because of the narrowness of cars. They're 6 feet wide, but we have 12-foot lanes because people weave back and forth. They're imprecise in their driving. They're not paying attention. An autonomous vehicle could be like a tracked vehicle, stay in lane. So for a 6-foot vehicle could have a 7-foot lane. So in that 3-lane highway, that's 36 feet, you can get a 3-lane highway down to 21 feet, and it'll be a more efficient highway in terms of moving vehicles because the autonomous vehicles could be more closely together.
GM recently announced plans to shut down 5 factories in North America and cut about 14,000 jobs. Earlier this year, Ford announced it will stop making sedans. In 2016, Fiat Chrysler stopped making small and mid-sized cars. I think GM is also going to be cutting back its, you know, mid-sized cars. And the emphasis seems to be in two directions, one on AVs, autonomous vehicles, and the other on, like, trucks and SUVs. So we seem to be heading in two opposite directions at the same time, in a way, like the most fuel-efficient and the least fuel-efficient cars and, you know, more lightweight autonomous vehicles and incredibly, like, big and heavyweight larger vehicles. Do you see us heading in two opposite directions at the same time?
Yeah, I'm very disappointed in that the auto industry, and it, you know, they're reflecting the desires of American people to be in bigger cars, to be in heavier vehicles, and to have these front ends that are so high. That has an impact. That's why pedestrian deaths, that's one of the main reasons pedestrian deaths have soared, is that people are getting hit by SUVs, getting hit no longer with knee injuries, and this comes from ER doctors who've seen me, who talked to me. There's a real connection between the health industry right now and transportation. They say in the past, someone got hit by a car. It was a knee injury. It was a leg injury. Now it's a chest injury, and those are more likely to be fatal. So I'm really not happy about that. But yes, it is going to be a problem moving heavier vehicles and trying to consume less energy.
Sam Schwartz, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much. This is really interesting. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sam Schwartz is the author of the new book, No One at the Wheel, Driverless Cars and the Road of the Future. He's a former traffic commissioner of New York City. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.